Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening, it's me, Nikovich, 2 Echo Zero Lima Uniform November. And it's, oh my god, it's early! If you're in the UK.
It's late and early. It's Friday evening for us here in the eastern portion of North America. Friday, March the 24th, 2017. So Universal Time, that would put it at 1 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, March the 25th, 2017. UK, is there summertime in the UK now?
It doesn't go back until next weekend.
Until next weekend. Okay, so they're still at... They're at 1 o'clock, I think, then, right?
Yeah, they're 4 hours ahead. They go back to 5 once the UK clocks go forward.
So it'll be back to 2 in the morning, I think, then, right?
Yeah, then it will be 2 in the morning again.
All right, but it'll feel like 3 in the morning.
Well, having done the show at 2 in the morning, it is a novel experience. Of course, it means, I tend to go back to bed for about a few hours. And then get up and do whatever I have to do on my list of things for Saturday. Sometimes I don't even bother going back to bed. I can go outside. I can go down the Radio Shack. I can turn a radio on, and I can tune it off the broadcast bands, and I can actually sit there and listen to the universe.
Yeah, nice.
Microwave background, but it permeates across all frequencies, and I can really have fun if I tune down to Jupiter, and sometimes of the year it is, oh gosh, it's overpowering.
Yeah, Jupiter white noise for sleeping by, that's kind of interesting.
Well, it's kind of a noise to stay awake by, because that's by that time I'm probably outside, I've got either the binoculars or the scope out, and I'm thinking, why go to bed?
I'm more of the, I guess it's the astronomer in me, the stay up late till all hours of the night, as opposed to going to bed early and getting up really early in the morning to see an event. I can't do that very well. Early in the morning would be like seeing something at 6 in the morning. I can't get up a little bit before to see something at 6. I could stay up all night long to see something at 6 in the morning, but I can't get up at 5 to see something and get out of bed and get outside to see something at 6 in the morning.
Yes, I can actually do that. I've done that because being a radio amateur, sometimes if you want it, there's a particular event in December. It's the Skywarn Appreciation Day over here in the US. And it actually starts, now it's one day, it's on a Saturday. It actually starts on a Friday night. So from about 7 o'clock Friday night through to approximately midnight Sunday morning, you have most of the national weather stations live on amateur radio, either actually on an FM repeater, on shortwave, or on Echolink. And this year, I got to work not only the National Hurricane Center, I got to work WA1, I got to work the Percy Hiram Memorial Station in Connecticut, as that was a bonus station. And boy, that was a fight to get. But it was worth it. And, of course, the other thing is, when you've got a shack full of radios and a long wire antenna, you have the sounds of the universe. You can listen to, you can tune around for the sun. You can tune around for Jupiter, for Sagae. You can do basically very primitive radio astronomy. And you don't need a dish. Yes, it's nice to have a dish. It means you can actually fine-tune stuff. You can go up into the microwave frequencies. You can listen on particular frequencies, the same as the professionals do. You can actually sit there and you can connect it to your computer. You can make a get a pen recorder going, or you can just record it digitally, and you can have a lot of fun. But as I say, for sheer staying awake ability, there is nothing like listening to Jupiter. And of course, right now, slowly but surely creeping northwards is Terry Lovejoy's new comet, 2017 Lovejoy E4. So, of course, everybody is staking out iTelescope and all the other remote scopes to get images once it actually gets properly into northern skies. Yes, I have got P45, I've got P41, I've got V2. I'm still working. I want to get Encke's comet because that's a regular occurrence.
Mm-hmm. Nice comet. But,
pun?
I've seen that several times. Nice comet. Not this time around, though.
Yeah. Not this time around. It's a little bit harder to get. But that is the whole fun of being a comet guy, mm-hmm. is actually sitting there either collecting your photons in directly over the internet, or even going out there yourself and using your own telescope and recording it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, half the time, I think the challenge is looking for it with the old Mark I eyeball. Now, for me, it's a little more difficult. I have varifocals. It does not like a telescope eyepiece. It does not like binoculars. But I suppose you can always take your glasses off and try and do it and focus the scope that way or the binoculars. It does work. In mm-hmm. fact, I'll be honest, everybody, I hear so many people whining about that bright silvery orb. We call it the moon. Mm-hmm. Hey, guys, if it wasn't for the moon, we wouldn't be here. And B, you know what? It's not a unchanging place. There are still plenty. There's still plenty of amateur work to be done, which the professionals want. There's still impacts going on the moon. They're still looking for people to image it from the Earth, and even just to spend the night recording the possible chance of an impactor. You know what? There's nothing boring about our satellite at all.
Well, you never know. If it weren't for like Jupiter, we might be dinosaurs.
If it wasn't for Jupiter.
We might, well, yeah. Well, maybe Jupiter helped deflect, you know, that dinosaur killer 65 million years ago. So maybe if there was no Jupiter, we'd be dinosaurs.
Possible. They did actually. I know some of the paleobiologists and certainly some of the paleontologists did speculate on what a dinosaur would have evolved into.
Mm-hmm.
And given the size of the brain cavity, I'm not actually saying about the actual brain size, but some of the dinosaurs had quite a large brain cavity. Would they have become intelligent after time? Well, we're never going to know because of one reason. They never had a space program. And you know what? This is very serious, folks, very serious. If it wasn't for our current space program, we might go the same way as the dinosaurs, because unless the various space powers, I'll just call them that, okay? We know who we're talking about. They need, well, a certain space power needs to get its act together and stop saying, oh, well, I don't see the financial necessity of finding a way to redirect asteroids. Guess what, Dodo? You're about to become one if it lands on your front door, because you're going to take the rest of us with you.
Well, I don't know. If dinosaurs had really good eyes, they could have worked on something on really small detailed stuff, because their hands were made for holding something right in front of their face while they're working on it. Their arms were nice and short. So maybe they actually were making like really tiny little sophisticated things that they've just – that's just, you know, eroded away now. We can't tell. It's possible.
Well, yeah. Velociraptors were a pack hunter. They were a pack animal. They coordinated everything. And I tend to think if you're going to have a dominant, intelligent dinosaur, it would have been perhaps Velociraptor,
mm-hmm.
because they already had the beginnings of they had coordination.
Mm-hmm.
The raptor you fear is not the raptor you see; it's the two that are coming to get you from the side or from behind.
All they might have needed was to cook their meat, and then they might have advanced.
I don't know. They probably found carrion that was pre-cooked.
Maybe, but that's one theory of advancing humans is that they started eating cooked meat, which helped increase their intelligence.
Well, Starstorm just pointed out in the film Jurassic Park, that very thing was actually pointed out that the Velociraptor was intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
It could vocalize, mm-hmm. and it could make decisions and think, and they had leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Your average T-Rex, he was a carrion-driven creature. If you actually look at the Rex, his jaw was not sturdy enough to be an attack predator. He and she probably depended a lot on carrion. Yes, there probably was something they could actually attack.
That jaw looked pretty good to me. We've got one in our museum that I look at every day, and it's pretty formidable, and it's right out front.
Yeah, but how solid is the actual bone structure? Is it hollow-boned or is it solid bone?
That I don't know if it's been determined. I'd have to look that one up.
I know that a lot of the experts, I think Jack Horner was one of them, were debating on whether or not Rex could actually do a tearing attack or whether it's dependent on carrion. Mm. But the problem is, unless we step into my blue box and go back,
exactly,
we're not going to know. And unless we find a planet that's been seeded with dinosaurs from Earth's parts, who knows?
I don't have a blue box. I have an ancient Egyptian column.
Yeah? I see you borrowed the Master's TARDIS then.
Exactly. All right, Nick got that one. Yes.
I would do. It's classic Doctor Who, my boy.
Awesome. I definitely want to say hi to everybody in our chat room, by the way. I forgot to do that. So we've got you and me, of course. We've got Glenn, Aquafew, In the Quiet Wood, Colm, 321. Glad to have you here. And open invitation to everybody out there listening right now. Come on over to the astronomy.fm chat room. Either go to the homepage or just type in astronomy.fm/chat. Either way, you'll get to the login page, type in a name, hit login, you'll be here. You can ask us questions. We'll put links to some of the articles that we talk about tonight so you can do further reading on your own time if you'd like to do that. So come on over and join us in the chat room, and we can listen to you while you're listening to us, type of thing.
And of course, the greatest thing is the work that was done by Eugene Shoemaker,
mm-hmm.
And David Levy, particularly with Shoemaker Levy 9, and the fact that Eugene was very much convinced of the fact that the craters on our planet were impact craters.
Yes.
Now, as I say, a lot of people didn't agree with him, but he stuck to it. He did the work, and he managed to prove his theory.
Especially the one in Arizona, Behringer Meteor Crater in Arizona.
Yeah.
I've been there. It's actually pretty cool.
I would love to go there. And I tend to think it was actually his work in the end that made it the place it is, because for so long people wanted to say even the impact craters on the moon were the result of volcanism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, there probably was some volcanism on the moon. If you
Definitely.
Just had a great chunk of rock going, you're probably going to go through the regolith to some degree. But the moon is pretty much quiet regarding a core.
Mm-hmm.
However, who knows, maybe the next real big impact that will create quite a nice splash and a nice central peak in a crater.
Mm-hmm. Got one. I'm going to put this question out to our chat room, but Aqua answered it a little bit. He said he'd been there too. I wanted to put it out to how many of you out there, listeners, have actually been to a meteor crater before, or how many? I've only been to one. Been meaning to go to another impact area in Sudbury, Canada. That's the next one closest to me, but yeah, I would really like to get to, that'd be kind of a fun list to do, to visit as many impact craters as you possibly can around the world.
Canada has quite a few, actually, when you look at the actual satellite imagery. Some of them mm-hmm. have been filled in with sediments. Mm-hmm. And of course, the real classic impact crater is the one we all can't visit, not without a gym diving suit, at least, the Chicxulub crater, because most of that's underwater.
Might be able to most of it, but I wonder if you could still get within the boundary if you just get onto the tip of the Yucatan Peninsula there.
Possibly, yeah.
Possibly. I have to look that one up again.
But you know what? It's always fascinating to think that if it wasn't for Chicxulub, we wouldn't have had the evidence we needed for A, for the mass extinction, and B, really, what caused it.
Well, there was still that iridium layers, so that was still the pretty good clue. Now, if there was some other clue at that boundary layer, something else, like, for instance, no iridium, but like tons of ash of some sort or some other chemicals, that would have led to a different theory of what caused that extinction. So it just depends on what's discovered, basically.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the real good stuff is when you look at the moon is probably our greatest indicator on how severe the bombardment really was. Now, the late great bombardment was a heck of a long time ago. But thinking about it, the moon was probably only recently formed.
Well, what do you want to consider recent?
Okay, let me just quickly go and Google that because I forget the actual date for the late great bombardment.
I think that's still, I think the moon's still back in the 4 billion years ago time zone. Not because life was what thought about 3.8 billion years ago. So I'm thinking the moon is still back around the 4 billion or a little bit farther.
Well, the LHB was an event thought to have occurred approximately 4.1 to 3.8 billion. And it's to the Neo-Hadarian and Eocene eras on Earth. So that's quite a step back in time, really. Of course, it's nothing if you're a Time Lord.
That's true.
But then again, neither is Event 1, I suppose.
Mm, that's right. I wanted to mention, since we're kind of started out talking about comets, I put in a link into our chat room of comets that are out there. This one, I just Google weekly bright comets. That gets me there. I've got two comet sites that I use. This one's a good one for just getting started out because it just gives a wide-angle map of where each comet is. There's actually four okay brightness comets in our sky right now. We'll go back to, Lovejoy is pretty faint. It's 10th, 11th magnitude, something like that. But 2015 V2 Johnson, 8.9 magnitude. That's getting definitely imageable. Pan-STAR.
I've already imaged it, Marty.
What was that?
I've already imaged it several times.
You've imaged that one, yes. Let's see. Pan-STARRS. There's a Pan-STAR still out there, so it'd be about 8.5 magnitude right now. Encke. Six to eighth magnitude, something like that. I'll have to look that one up again. Last time I looked, I was not able to see it. I think it's kind of spread out and not very faint. But there is 41P Tuttle Jacobini Krasek is about 6th magnitude right now.
And it's a really diffuse coma. There isn't that much of a tail there, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But so, you know what? It's still good fun.
That means it's going to be dimmer than this magnitude. If it's diffuse, it's actually quite a bit harder to see than something that would be 6th magnitude. Like a 6th magnitude globular cluster, you can pretty much pick up with your eye without a telescope. Pair of binoculars have no problem. But 6th magnitude comet generally tend to be much fainter than that. Sometimes they get to be about 10th magnitude when it's more like a reality check there. So take it with a grain of salt. I want to kind of come up with a little – I've always been meaning to come up with a better way of describing the brightness of a comet than the method, the out-of-focus star method. I don't really like that method at all.
Well, to be honest, a lot of people compare it to a similar magnitude star, probably the best way to do it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interesting news.
Well,
in April, 41P and – V2 are supposed to meet.
Oh, okay.
Okay, let me just pull up the link for that. This one's a second.
Go ahead. I'm going to look up where 41P happens to be right now. Let's see. Today is March the 20-something. And let's see. That puts it almost in the bowl of the Big Dipper. It should be right about in the bowl of the Big Dipper right now. Between the two bottom stars of the bowl of the Big Dipper, kind of close to the lower pointer star of the bowl of the Big Dipper. You know, the two front stars of the bowl of the Big Dipper are called the pointer stars because they point towards the North Star Polaris. The bottom star is about where that comet is at. Now, there's another website that does give a more detailed map than this one. And what is it? What is that acronym for that? Let's see. You got weekly bright comets and something else. It's under Skyhound, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Skyhound have a very good page. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I really do recommend. I'm not paid to say this. I will say this right now. Their sky tools are excellent for scheduling comet observations. They've actually upgraded the sky. They're offering sky tools for now.
Cool.
Here's, I use it ACP.
It's chasing comets. If you just Google the phrase chasing comets, that works better for getting right to the comet section. And this is a much more detailed star chart. It's got pretty much daily positions for this comet. So the other site had like every 2 weeks positions, something like that. This one's got daily positions, and you can zoom in on it. It's got, you know, stars down to magnitude 8th, 9th, something like that on the chart. So it makes it much easier to find. You can print the chart out. Well, okay, if you're old school like me, you don't bring the laptop out or the tablet out. You can actually print the star chart out. Put a red light behind it, hold it up to the sky with your binoculars, and then start finding the stars on the chart that are near the comet position. That's what I usually do. Just identify those stars and then figure out if it happens to be like right next to one of the stars. Then you find that faint star, and then you'll know if you're actually seeing the comet or not. So this one actually looks pretty decent. Oh, I've got, okay, more detail here. We are pretty much in the middle. Let's see, we're after, oh, it was the 25th, just leaving the bowl. So it's just north of the bowl of the Big Dipper right now.
Okay, Marty, I'm going to interrupt for a second. So I'm going to put my Comet Watch hatch on.
I'm done. Go ahead.
Okay. 2P Enki will reach perihelion in early March. Also in early March, this comet will pass within 0.7 AU of the Earth. It's currently predicted to reach a maximum brightness of about 4. In early March. Beware. It is large and diffuse, and that will make it harder to spot once than its magnitude alone would suggest. 45P, HRMP, passed perihelion in December. In early February, this comet passed within 0.1 AU of the Earth. 73P, Schwachmann-Wachmann, split into two as of February 10th.
Is it Schwachmann-Wassmann, W-A-S-S?
No, W-A-C-H-M-A-N-N.
Okay.
Okay. So the new component is larger and substantially brighter, forming a comet pair. The pair will next perihelion in mid-March when they'll be their brightest. 41P, TGK, will next reach perihelion in mid-April. In early April, the comet will pass within 0.1 AU of the Earth. It's currently predicted to reach a maximum brightness of magnitude 5.5 in April. Okay, comet C2016VZ187 Pan-STARRS. Discovered in November, it may have brightened in late February. It will reach perihelion in early March. In April, this comet will pass within 0.5 AUs of Earth. 2015 ER61 Pan-STARRS, that will reach perihelion in early May. It's predicted, I say predicted, to reach a maximum brightness of magnitude 8.8 in late April. Our good old friend C2015 Van Johnson.
There you go, Van Johnson. Sounds good to me.
Will reach perihelion in mid-June of 2017. It's currently predicted to have magnitude 7. I'm not going to say minus 7 because I don't believe that. 237P Linear will have passed perihelion in mid-October. It reached a maximum brightness in late September. And our good old friend 29P Schwachmann-Wachmann 1 has had another large outburst near the beginnings of November. It reached 12.8 magnitude. It's now faded to 15th. Outbursts occur roughly every 50 days. Now, I really do suggest you use one of the resources I use is cometchasingskyhound.com.
Mm-hmm.
because they actually change the page every month. And they actually have a picture of 73P and 73BT as of February 13th. You can read an article about the image stack. And there's also a movie made from the same set of images. So,
I like both websites. Weekly Break Comets for just basically telling me what constellation the comet is in. And then I could go to my star chart and say, okay, let's find out if that's actually above my horizon at a reasonable time. Or is that, you know, right next to the sun or something like that. So I'll use a general star chart first. Give me what part of the sky it's in. If it's a morning sky, evening sky, southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere, stuff like that. And then I go to the Chasing Comets site and get the detailed chart out to really actually look for it.
And of course, the nice thing about the Skyhound page is it gives you an idea of what you can use to see it. Mm-hmm. For instance, they say 41P is a morning comet visible in binoculars. It's got about a 14.5 degree coma. It's moving into Draco at the moment. Enki is in Pisces. Look for a 2.5 degree coma. ER61 Pan-STARRS, small telescope, and that's in Sagittarius. V2 Johnson is a small telescope object. It's got it's about a 2.5 degree coma. It's in Hercules. 73P is in Sagittarius, moving into Sagittarius by the month's end. And they begin the month in Ophiuchus at magnitude 10.1 to 12.2. And that's between a 2 to 40 degree, and between the two of them is 2/40 degree comas. The fainter component is visible in an 8-inch or larger telescope. 237P Linear, morning object in an 8-inch telescope, currently slowly moving into Pegasus by month's end. Leonis. Now that you're going to need a big instrument. You're going to need at least 12.5 inches. It's currently in Ursa Major. And it's got a 25-degree coma. It's fading. What else? 45P, you need an 18-inch telescope.
Mm-hmm. And usually that means perfect skies, too.
Pretty much, yes. It's in Leo. It begins the month in Leo. VS18 Pan-STARRS, it's an evening comet. I like to say this, in very large telescopes.
Yes.
S2 Pan-STARRS. Very large telescope, morning, it's in Corvus. And that's about it, folks. As I say, if you want to see these resources kept going, go visit the pages. Your hits count. Because at the end of the day, some of these pages are, okay, one's put out by the British Astronomical Association. They're going to do it regardless because their members use it. People like Skyhound would really appreciate the hits. Because then if they know it's being used, they will keep doing it. And no, I don't work for them, and I am not paid to say anything about them by them. I just happen to like their products. So, like I say.
I have to send a message that we use their website.
Yes, we do. During our show. Really should, because for them, it means that it's an appreciated resource, and it's getting out to people.
And if our listeners go to their website and tell them that they heard about them on astronomy.fm radio, that's a boost for us too.
Yep, it is. And you know what? There's at least two groups I know of that do actually plug us. That's the Central New York Astronomers Group here in upstate New York, because they actually have a link to our page on their website.
Mm-hmm. I think a few places do. Let's see, Charlie Bates Solar Astronomy Project does, our buddy Stephen Ramsden, and telescopes.net does too.
It's a case of the old maxim, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. People appreciate us because we mention them, and they mention us in return, which is great. It's how it should be. And of course,
I had to buy a back scratcher. Nobody scratches my back anymore.
I have two back scratchers, one I keep at home, one I keep at work.
A little bit of conversation in the chat room about moving objects, like watching, some of these comets move pretty quickly. The one, the Big Dipper, actually moves rather quickly. You can notice movement of it. And then the question was on Pluto moving across the sky. Two different situations as far as movement, though. The comet is fairly close to the Earth, and it literally moves fast across our view because it's close to the Earth, and because of its orbit through the solar system. Now, Pluto is a different situation. Pluto's movement is mostly related to the movement of the Earth around the Sun. So its actual movement, you know, to the stars is quite slow, but the Earth moving around the Sun, when you look at it, it makes Pluto look like it's actually moving for most of our orbit backwards. And it's the motion of the Earth that we see reflected in Pluto when we look at Pluto. It's that
now,
parallax
effect. The interesting thing is, if you're going for really faint planets, and to me, okay, I'm sorry, I went through school, I started my degree, Pluto was a planet. Now, at the end of the day, Pluto is, okay, the IAU says it's a minor planet because it hasn't cleared its orbit. Well, guess what, folks? In that case, the Earth hasn't cleared its orbit, and it too is a minor planet because we have Trojans that follow us front and behind, so therefore we haven't cleared our orbit. Now, if I'm imaging, when I have imaged Pluto, I take roughly about 5 images, and I space them about an hour apart. And then I use a piece of software to blink the images. You can also obviously make an animation if you wish as well. That too works. But that's the only way you're going to see movement on an astronomical image, is to blink them or make an animation. And there are some wickedly good animations of some of the comets out there right now. So keep your eyes peeled and look around the net. And look in groups which have solid images and comic guys in this membership to get the real images, not the fakes. And I will say this, comets are like cats. They have tails and they do wish with them as they wish. The same with their magnitudes. We were expecting some great things from certain comets and sadly they didn't happen. But that's just part and parcel of being an astronomer, whether you're professional or amateur.
And if you could get close enough to a comet, you could hear it purr.
I am not quite sure about that. I would have to ask David Levy first. However, it is a good name for a cat.
There you go. By the way, secret's out, everyone. It just so happens that you're listening to the Event Horizon radio program on astronomy.fm. It is now 9:33 in the evening on March the 24th, 2017. Lots of time for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America with daylight savings time. So universal time, that would put it at 1:33, March the 25th, Saturday morning, 2017. So you're listening to us live. We still have about another half hour's worth of programming tonight. So stick around, keep going. Of course, we have more programming after our show, so continue listening on. Now, if you miss this program, you might catch us on the repeat. We repeat everything for about every 4 hours for the next 24 hours, so you can catch us a little bit later, too, if you'd like to.
And the best thing is we do post the show notes on the AFM website. Mm-hmm. For everybody to listen to use when they listen to. And here is a big shout out to our friends at the Astronomy Outreach of Kosovo. I hope you're all listening, guys. It's nice to have you around.
Yes, indeed. Hi, Primavera.
Hi, Primavera.
All right, let's see. Where was I going to go? Oh, let's say hi to the people in chat room. We've got Glenn, Aquafew, In the Quiet Wood, Colm321, and Richie just joined us not too long ago, so glad to have you here.
You asked a question in the chat room.
All right, let's go for it.
Basically, the question was about imaging Pluto, all 5 pics within the hour or hour apart. I tend to take them an hour apart. That allows some movement, and that is what you're looking for when you're blinking pictures. That is what allowed Clyde Tombaugh to actually find Pluto in the first place. He saw something moving in his images, in his plates.
More than that, he actually saw something moving the correct amount. Because when you take several pictures and you blink them, you might see a lot of things moving in there. You might catch up a satellite once in a while. You might catch a geosynchronous satellite. There's lots of other asteroids in there that you'll pick up. But you have to know how far the thing is going to move to determine its distance, and that's what Clyde Tombaugh did. They said that they discovered tons and tons of asteroids.
Yeah,
that they saw blinking. It was actually saw moving back and forth, but it didn't move the correct amount. Pluto would move less than an asteroid.
Yeah, and of course the other thing is, when you're imaging like that, you need to have the object of your image dead center. I always try when I'm doing my imaging, I try to set it so that the object is dead center. So I'm looking for something that's in the middle of the image of the photo to move.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of imaging, I've been working on the scope system at work. In fact, just worked on it last Thursday night. We're having a couple of issues. We thought we're having some chattering. We thought we had in the drive. We thought we had, which we pretty sure we do. We had some pointing errors. So we had some of the telescope technician come out, look at some of the equipment, found out part of the problem was, yes, our network system was off by a full minute in time, so the computer wasn't pointing correctly, so it was making the telescope point off by, like, you know, an arc minute or something like that. So that was all kind of messed up. And he did some corrections, also showed us a little bit more detail, complicated mount, on how to re-verify its position. And I'm going to get a manual on that, and hopefully I can understand half what he's saying. Because when he was telling me about, well, yeah, you got to do this, you got to do that, and this, that, and this, that, I was like, oh, what does that mean, and what does that mean? Yeah, the telescope technician, professional telescope technician, was definitely a different field than I'm used to of astronomy. So we're getting there. Then we tried a new program called Nebulosity, because Maxim DL to me was way too complicated to use. So somebody suggested Nebulosity. So we got that in there from one of our experienced amateur astronomer astrophotographers, and we tried doing some work with that. Found a couple of issues with it. Well, one issue with the program itself, and that was, which we still have to figure out, for some reason it would only image when we do 2x2 binning. Mm-hmm. 2x2 binning means, well, instead of considering your one pixel, which is basically a tiny little light center square, one little dot, a one point for, you know, light to fall on, and you know, shows the image, and each little dot will have a light value or mm-hmm. dark value. Well, some things you can do called binning. Basically, you combine four pixels as a cluster together, and they think they're one pixel. What that does is it loses resolution, but it makes the image appear faster. The software can process one quarter of the information as opposed to, you know, four times as much information. So basically, it's a lot easier to, for instance, if you want to focus your object, you want to find an object and you have to center it up, it's a lot easier if the images come through a little faster than instead of four times slower. That's called binning. So you could do 3x3 binning, which basically combines nine pixels together, and they think they're all one pixel, and it works nine times faster. That's a general representation of how it works. The speed is a little different than that, but that's generally it. So for some reason, we could only get the program to show or take an image when it was binning 2x2, which means combining four pixels together. For some reason, when it was just on individual pixels, it would show an error. And he said he's seen that. He has seen that online somewhere, and he's going to go back over, check some of the Yahoo user groups and find out what that's about, if there's a fix for it or what the deal is. That was kind of an unusual one that came up. Let's see. Another thing we were trying to use the guide camera. It's actually, instead of the main camera, there's another separate little camera attached to the telescope. It's in the same light path as the main part of the telescope. There's just a tiny little mirror, kind of like your car having a rearview mirror in front of the windshield. So looking at this tiny little mirror, we can pick up maybe one or two stars and use them to guide the main telescope without taking away too much light from the camera that way. Just take a tiny little slice and use it for making sure that the telescope doesn't drift out of the way. A couple issues we found with that. One was the main scope, the focal length is so huge, and we're catching such a little small piece of light that the atmospheric distortion was not allowing us to focus a star to a real sharp point. It was kind of blobby, and it was kind of faint. So the guide camera could actually not pick up enough light from that star, which we could barely see, to make a guide. And we also found a little defect in the drive system. There was something called backlash. The way that gears mesh together, when the drive gear goes against the gear on the shaft, the closer they are to each other, it maintains contact. And when the gears, you know, rotate one way forward, it maintains contact. But when you back up the telescope a little or go into a different direction, sometimes there can be the slightest gap between the gears. So there will be a slight delay before the gears engage in reverse. Well, in the declination axis, that's basically the north and south axis, the spacing in the gears was so bad that the software could actually not back up the telescope and remember where it was. So it created an error, and the software could not actually guide the telescope, could not point it, keep it pointed exactly where it was supposed to. So we have to figure out, maybe we have to do some adjustment on the declination gears and get them meshed in a little tighter so that that sloppiness in there is a lot tighter, and it'll work a lot better that way. So continuing efforts. So we're really starting to get into the little details of the scope. Mostly it's just been for general public, just general viewing. Look at the moon, look at the planets, a couple of sorry, deep space objects for the public, and that was it. But nope, now we're starting to use it like after hours for some more serious work, more practice.
Yeah, and I think that's something every imager should be doing is practicing.
Yes.
Because I'll be honest, I'm learning a new system right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's called PixInsight.
Ah, yes. It's a image a picture processing software, isn't it?
It is a I think the best way to describe it is learn the process, watch the videos, do it, because then you will get some very good images out of it.
The program PixInsight actually corrects the images that you take. Is that correct?
Yeah, it does everything. It does the things Maxim doesn't quite do for you. It will do even more for you if you really want it to. But then you're going to start talking about some pretty heavy automation in the observatory. I'm slowly learning it. Maybe next year I'll buy it and use it as my main processing software. But it is a very, very intensive learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've seen so far, it may be well, well worth it. What can you say? It's definitely got a wow factor to it.
Well, what I was going to say is the learning curve is basically you have to learn different terminology that you're not used to.
Yep.
And when somebody makes up a computer program, whatever their background is, they will name things, and it's like a foreign language. So you have to learn the foreign language, like, what does this word mean? It's not a normal word. It's a normal word, but now it means something different. So you have to learn almost like a secret code of what they're talking about. And then there's always the usual drop-down menus with another menu underneath it and another menu underneath it and another menu underneath it. And each of those menus have common words that mean something totally different, so you have no idea what they mean.
In fact, one of the things I've noticed with observatory automation is that you never stop learning. I'm learning a new planetarium program. I have two now. I have Starry Nights Pro Plus, and I have Pro Plus 6, and I have Sky X. My Starry Nights does things that my Sky X won't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do things on Sky X that I know I can do on Starry Nights. It will just give me a show me where against a grid a comet is.
Mm-hmm.
I can't at the moment. I'm still figuring out how to do that on Sky X.
Mm-hmm.
Sky X is much easier to interface to a telescope.
Yes,
and it doesn't. It has its own drivers, including ones for my Newtonian, which is great. Otherwise, I've got to use ASCOM drivers. ASCOM drivers are perfectly great. However, some of these programs are now becoming to the point they are pretty much a self-contained observatory. You sit there, you use something like ACP or you use Sky Tools. You decide what you want to see for the night or what you want to image for the night. You can then write, it will then write a program, which incidentally you can use if you're remoting on iTelescope.
Mm-hmm.
Now that to me, this is one of the big things. This is one of the things I really liked about the SkyX, and I really like about Sky Tools, is the fact that I can sit there, I can plan a whole night's imaging for, say, one of the scopes in Spain at Nerpico, mm-hmm. or Mayhill, or Siding Springs. It will tell me what's going to be visible when. I can look, I can go on to iTelescope, I can look for the breaks and the spaces for the night schedule, or I can look at the next two nights. I can put my reservation in. I can upload my little program to do everything I need it to do. It will pick the filters. It will decide if I need to guide or not, or if I need autofocus. It will literally do everything for you, which is great, because if particularly if I'm remoting, it means I can set everything up, I can go to work, and I can wait to get an email at work to say, hey, Nick, it's ready for you. Come and collect the image.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then I have options. I can either just download the JPEG that they give me, which is fine. For that's Facebook, that's fine. It's a nice picture for Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
If I really, really want to have some fun, I can then download it, put it into an imaging program like PixSight, like MaximDL, Nebulosity, and then I can download my flats, my darks, and my FITS files, and then go in and either let the program just do it on its own. Some of these programs you can just tell, here's the FITS files, here is the flats, here's the darks, go for it. And you can just let your computer run for however long it tells you it's going to take to process, and you get your picture out. Personally, mm-hmm. I like to be hands on. This is why I like my radios to have no menus, because I like to have my finger on the dial and slowly be turning the dial for that signal, for that one QSO. So that's why most of the time when I do processing myself, I actually don't let the computer do it automatically. I'm sitting there and I'm tweaking it myself. And you can do that. These programs have either an automatic mode or they have a manual mode. And mm-hmm. it is really down to the user exactly what you want to do. And I think this is perhaps the best thing. A lot of things, you stack your images, the program picks your best ones, processes them. You just have to provide the images or the AVI files, particularly if you're using something like Registax. Nothing wrong with that. But I like to have that hands-on. I like to tweak things. What happens if I tweak this or tweak that? But this is the big but. You should always, always make a note of what you've done. Keep a notepad and make a note of what you just did. So I tweaked the red X and tweaked things X. That way, if you need to go back, and you're going to do this, you are going to need to go back, you know how to set things back to get back to a point where it didn't go disastrously wrong. And that is the important thing. You need to keep notes. And to be honest, when you're processing your images, they should form part of your observing notes, because you can guarantee you're going to post that picture. It's going to be an amazing, it's going to blow everybody's minds. And someone's going to say, Nick, how did you do it? What did you do? What mm-hmm. program did you use? And if you can give them a step by step of what you did, yes, they're going to go away. They're going to have their own pictures. They're going to duplicate what you did. Will it work? Don't know. Because at the end of the day, there's an old saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I know guys who image comets daily. They prefer to have reverse images. They prefer to have a white sky and black images, the stars, etc., as black. Some guys prefer to keep it normal, which is fine. Some prefer to shoot luminance only. Some guys go the full Monty and use every available filter they've got or can get or can use. That's fine. At the end of the day, it is always going to be a personal preference. But all I will say is, please, please make notes. Record them. Use something like SkyTools. Use your notebooks and keep track of what you've done. Because at the end of the day, and this is probably an old thing I've said, somebody in the professional world is going to see that picture. And it's going to be, oh my God, I have been looking for that image in that particular way. How did you do it? How did you get that result? Then you can submit that picture. They will use it in their paper. And they will then be able to submit exactly step by step what you did. You get the credit. They have to credit you. If they use your image and your process, they have to credit you. And at the end of the day, it is perhaps the ultimate accolade is to have your image with your method in somebody's paper. It'll get peer reviewed. It will get published on the databases and in magazines like Nature, etc. But your name is going to be there under that image taken by Nicky Vets, Marty Coons, whoever. So at the end of the day, if you can tell the guy who used your image in his paper how you got your results, then he can put that into the paper, which is what he needs to do. It's no use saying, oh, here's a pretty picture from Nicky Vets. Brilliant. Anybody can take a pretty picture. But they need to be able to reproduce your results. They need your original files. This is something people don't realize. At the end of the day, you have to provide not only the result, you have to provide the original files and the method. Because they're going to have to go through it. They're going to have to demonstrate it at the peer review. There will be some bigwig professor or specialist who will look at this paper and he will be on the panel that is judging it as is this accurate or not. And he will want to do everything you just did to get that image that showed that important facet of that comet, minor planet, or whatever. So write it down, commit it to paper, commit it to an electronic file that is in a portable state. Make it a document, make it a text file. That way, when it comes to the crunch, here it is. It can be translated into any whatever particular electronic medium they're using. They can see it, they can do it, and they can say, yes, fine, rubber stamp it. Ba-bam.
Yeah, I rarely take notes with anything like that. Like somebody wants to use my images. They just go ahead and use them. That's fine. I don't put any little disclaimers on my photos or anything like that. So what you could say is I'm a rebel without a clause.
But are you part of the alliance? No, but seriously.
Even
when I'm using a remote telescope, don't I put my Shirley. Name. But I won't call you Shirley, don't worry. Roger. The thing is, at the end of the day, if it's being used in a scientific manner, it's got to be reproducible. And yes, with the current vogue for stealing people's images and claiming they're your own, darn right, I go into the actual file itself, and I put my name, how I took it, where I took it, etc. Because you know what? If those tags get wiped out and someone uses it, wiped out, then come on, it's obvious that you're stealing somebody's picture. And the fact that it has my name, it has which telescope I use, it has the object, it has the date, you're going to have to go pretty hard to scrub out and replace the stars that are behind it.
Well, as we've been talking about lately, Venus is almost at inferior conjunction, which means it'll pass from the evening into the morning skies. Conjunction is technically when the sun and Venus have the same declination. That's a coordinate line running north to south. That's supposed to happen tomorrow, sometime like that. Now, this conjunction is actually going to be fairly well separated. You know, sometimes Venus will pass right in front of the sun. Sometimes it passes north of the sun, south of the sun. This time it's actually going to pass north of the sun at a fair distance of about 7 degrees. Now, I just happened to look at an image Venus a couple days ago at about a 9-degree separation. Kind of close, kind of dangerous. Don't do this at home. I'm very, very experienced at photographing Venus close to the sun without ruining camera, telescope, or eyeball. I got some okay images. The skies were kind of bouncy around, a lot of jiggling, so it was kind of hard for me to get some really good, sharp images. I got some that are kind of close. I'm going to send them to a friend of mine. He's going to try to image process them, clean them up a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you want to see a pretty good picture, a really good picture of Venus round conjunction, go to spaceweather.com. There's a good picture. There's a good picture in there. You have to use a lot of magnification. Of course, the more magnification you use, the jumpier the image is, actually. So it's actually harder, more magnification. So I did get it pretty close. I don't know if it's going to be clear here tomorrow. I think I will go get the telescope out and try to shoot it tomorrow when it's basically officially at conjunction. Mm-hmm. And I should have no problem getting it. But I've always wanted to do this. I've kept saying I'm going to do the same thing with this. Never actually imaged it at or looked at it at conjunction. And this year, so far it's happening. Just got to have the weather cooperating. So 2 days ago it was clear. Today, marginal. Hopefully tomorrow. No, tomorrow's supposed to rain. So I guess 3 days away from conjunction is close enough. And I'll have the images out sometime.
If you're using a filter on your telescope, please don't put a filter at the eyepiece. They're normally glass. They're cheap. They're horrible. And you're risking your vision. Put a piece of filter film across the front of your telescope. It doesn't cost you that much to do. It's actually pretty cheap.
Well, that's for looking at the sun, yes. But I was looking at Venus, which cannot have a filter on the telescope. So it's a really high-risk operation. Mm. If you're not experienced with this, don't do it.
To be honest, if I'm going to do it, I'll do it with somebody else's equipment. I ain't risking my own. And let's face it, Marty. You're using using Cranbrook's equipment?
Yes.
So it's not your money, is it?
Yeah, well, it kind of is anyways, yes.
Yeah, they'll probably kick
If I break it, it's my money, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of the sun, there is one tiny little sunspot on the sun right now, designated active region 2643, smaller than the Earth. In fact, this is the kind of sunspot that people used to think it was another planet, like, and they named it Vulcan. No, it's just one tiny little spot on the sun, barely there. In fact, it'd actually be a challenge to find it. You have to actually try to look for it. You have to increase the magnification. So it's something on the sun. Give it a shot. Now, there have been some pretty high solar winds coming off the sun recently. Oh, there's my clock going. The gong show. We're actually going to go a little long during the live portion tonight, everybody. So stick around for a little bit. And then during the repeats, we'll get it locked down to the hour length. But we're going to go maybe about 10 minutes long for our live portion here. So stick around with us. Some high solar winds in the past few days was up to almost at least 700 kilometers per second. Right now we're at 470 kilometers per second. Now, high winds, but the particle densities have been low, down to just about 2 protons per cubic centimeter. But that's still enough with the high speeds to kick up some aurora at high latitudes. So if you live near the poles, you've got a good chance of seeing some aurora.
Can I make you jealous, Marty?
All righty.
There is an aurora going on at the moment.
Yes.
Yes. It is a radio aurora. It's at about 67.5 degrees latitude. Even though the main aurora band is actually closed, that it is actually happening right now.
Yeah, that's what they've been saying for a few days now. So cool. Let's see. Coming up Sunday, the 26th, there's Neptune will be 0.005 degrees north of the moon in occultation. This is one of these things on U.S. Naval Observatory's Astronomical Almanac Online website that I need to go and check this a little bit tighter, because from what I see, there's supposed to be an occultation. The separation is much greater than what they're reporting here. So, different. My star chart's showing a different separation than what they're reporting.
Well, I think the nice thing is everybody's complaining about the sun being boringly dead. You know what? It isn't. Even during solar minimum, there is occasional surprises, and it's just a case of watching the space weather websites to see what's going on.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, getting a new note from our radio director. We're going to have to wrap it up, so we're not going to go 10 minutes longer.
Okay.
We're going to kind of head out of here then.
Right, okay, Marty. I better send the message. Landing party to Miranda. To the beam up.
Thanks, everybody in chat tonight. Really appreciate you being here and all your listeners today. Good night, everyone.
Night, everyone.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.